I'll have students in my intro to digital class where I'll ask them, is photography an art form? And half of them raise their hands and the other half look kind of uncomfortable because it isn't always an art form to them. You know, the second you pick up a brush, you load it with paint and you start twirling it on a canvas, you've made something that is art. Mm-hmm. But when you pick up a camera and take a photograph, it isn't necessarily art every time.
Welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast, brought to you by CloudSpot, the easiest way to deliver and even sell your photos online. I'm your host, Raymond Hatfield, and each week I interview one of the world's most interesting photographers to learn what it really takes to capture beautiful images and compelling stories so that you can start to do the same. Today is an episode from the BPP Vault. After years of interviewing world-class photographers, we have built a rich library of photo tips and tricks that guests share to help you to get better at capturing amazing images. With new listeners finding the show every day, these Rewind episodes allow for new listeners to discover the gold nuggets of the past and also allow longtime listeners to revisit an interview with fresh ears and more hands-on experience to draw from. So in today's interview, we are chatting with contemporary art photographer Chris Grunder. Now, contemporary art may not mean the same thing, to two different people. If you don't know much about it, it can seem kind of vague, you know? Now, Chris teaches photography at Sonoma State University, and he is also the co-owner of Bass and Rainer, which is a contemporary art gallery in San Francisco. So who better than Chris to give us a proper definition of what contemporary art is in today's interview? So with that, let's go ahead and get on into this conversation with Chris Grunder. Today you teach photography at Sonoma State University.
Yeah.
You host art shows as the director of Bass and Rainer. Mm-hmm. So art obviously influences your life. It's made a big impact on you. That's apparent. But I want to know, like, when did all of this art influence start for you? And when did you understand that photography was simply going to play a role in your life?
Yeah, my mom's an artist, it's not something that's been her career. It's something that's just been kind of always present. And so there have been artists around, there's been art around. And I don't think I thought of it as a career path, actually, until fairly late, anyway, until I was sort of in college. But it was just always present and always had an impact on me. And I couldn't draw to save my life. I couldn't paint. I couldn't sculpt. I tried my hand at all the things and just didn't have that ability to kind of mimic in the way that art education tries to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff a little bit. Like at the elementary, sort of primary level, it just wasn't there, but I still had the love for it. So I studied art history in college, and I remember the exact moment. It was such a weird instance, but a friend from high school had been taking photos, and she was off at college, and she said, "Hey, check out this page of my photos." I was like, "What do you mean, page of your photos?" And it was a Flickr page, and I looked at it. I was like, "Oh, these are good photos. I like these." And then I started going through Flickr and seeing literally millions of photos in an afternoon, and they were all, looking back, I mean, they're all horrible, but they were these amateur photos that were a level above what I had seen in amateur family photos. And they were not quite yet what I was seeing in the commercial world or in the fine art world. Like when I go to a museum, I'm seeing like a Thomas Demand or a Candida Hoffer or these like, or a Jeff Wall, these like big, beautiful things or a Avedon. And so I didn't understand the point A to point B prior to seeing Flickr. And all of a sudden I was like, ah, there is an in-between and these people are getting better and becoming better photographers and moving towards this thing. This is how this skill gets developed. And it was sort of this moment of like downloading the internet into my brain where I could see, I could go through and watch these people progressing over time. I could see like, oh, this is where they figured out this thing. And this is all before I had a properly functioning camera. And so that summer, I want to say I went back to Alaska, and mentioned this to my mom, and she's like, "Well, there's a camera just sitting here. It's an old 35 millimeter camera. Pick it up. You know, here's some expired film that's been sitting in the closet, and see what happens." And so I shot through 16 rolls of, you know, Kodak Gold 400, got them developed. They were all over the place because the thing didn't have a working light meter. And I bought maybe 16 more rolls and shot those, and then did that probably 3 or 4 cycles of that in the month that I was home. And by the end of it, knew how, like, based on lighting conditions, how to operate a camera. And I never stopped from there. It was just like, this is the thing. This is the direct path between the aesthetics I'm seeing in the world and loving and my expression of them. You know, there's the Tarkowski quote that photography is just the act of pointing things out elevated to an art form. It's like, that's what I was feeling. I was seeing things and noticing things and wanting those to be codified. And so that's the moment of its sort of transition, and where I thought, I don't have to be an art historian. I can actually be a practitioner of this as well.
So this was just shortly after high school, correct?
Yeah, this is like early in college, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so going back to kind of those earlier days when you were learning just art, and you kind of had this realization of like, you know what, maybe I'm not cut out to be painting and stuff.
Yeah.
Was that because you just assumed that because you didn't have this maybe quote-unquote natural talent that it wasn't cut out for you?
Absolutely. I think it was entirely a failing of our educational system. I think it was and of our sort of what our culture broadly values. You know, I mean, my parents are fairly cultured people by the standards of Anchorage, Alaska. You know, my mom, I think now, is actually tremendously cultured, and my dad has actually grown into it more as well. But, you know, we're talking about the early 1990s when there wasn't the media we have now. And so I think that the idea of being an artist was tied up in the idea of kind of manual reproductive dexterity, this natural talent, or maybe it wasn't natural. Maybe it was, you know, something you worked at, but if you couldn't draw a tree and have it look like a tree, then you weren't an artist. And of course, like, now looking back, I'm like, that's a huge problem, because that's the least important skill for any working artist, you know, at the contemporary art level. So shouldn't we be encouraging different behavioral modes in the education at the lower level? But it just hasn't caught up yet. So that's exactly what it was. It was the lack of that kind of dexterity with the skills I thought were necessary to be an artist. You know, looking at a Caravaggio painting and thinking like, I couldn't ever reproduce that. Like, I couldn't master those brush strokes. I couldn't do that. It's like, of course you couldn't. You know,
yeah.
he couldn't. He wasn't the only person doing that. Like, he had 10 hands on that painting, and he also had a camera obscura. So, like, you know, it wasn't just the manual dexterity. That's absolutely what it was.
I remember I was very similar at a very early age. I wanted to draw. I wanted to paint, but found no natural talent at it. And I remember. And it's funny, I didn't even think about this until right now that you had told that story. But I remember in fifth grade, I went to Washington, D.C., and we went to go see, like, the Smithsonian's. And I remember seeing a Rembrandt painting for the first time and thinking to myself, like, I'll just never paint again. Like, there's no way that I could ever do this. So why even continue to try?
Yeah.
But when it came to photography for you, was it simply that gave you hope the fact that you had seen others through, like, a visual representation of their progression? Was that what gave you hope?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think I had some, it's funny, I had some slight inkling of photography as a art form, but just barely. I don't think that's something that's baked into our culture. Yeah. In fact, I know it's not, because I'll have students in my intro to digital class where I'll ask them, is photography an art form? And half of them raise their hands and the other half look kind of uncomfortable. And then they slowly raise their hands, or some of them don't raise their hands. They're not sure that it is an art form because it isn't always an art form to them. You know, the second you pick up a brush, you load it with paint and you start twirling it on a canvas, you've made something that is art. Mm-hmm. But when you pick up a camera and take a photograph, it isn't necessarily art every time. You know, if you're hunting around your house for the things that you need at the grocery store, is that art? Is that expression? Like, not not the same way that moving a brush around is, right? So that's something I go over with them.
Yeah.
And so I think it was, yeah, I think it was that like was holding me up a little bit. And it was when I saw that, there is this higher mode. There is this poetry that's embedded within this medium. That's actually like deeply embedded and hiding and not always, sometimes it's latent and not always there. That's when it like sort of came across. For a second, I want to go back though, because it sounds like I'm on the people who have manual dexterity in the arts. And like,
no.
Recently, like I did a Zoom interview with this artist, Ray Mack, and she's a fantastic painter. And like, she was making a painting and like in three moves of her wrist had made a face that like made me want to cry. Like not because I couldn't do it, because I was like, that's such an evocative face. And I was like, that's magic. It absolutely is. But it's just that like, that's not the only magic. Right? There's like subtler magic at play.
Right. Because we're all just humans. We all have different backgrounds. And yeah, no, I get that. I want to go back to that example that you had of painting versus photography and whether or not it's art. You know, obviously somebody who could, I mean, I have a wall right here that I need to paint.
Yeah.
But that's not going to be art. Mm-hmm. Right. So in that sense, that's not going to be art, in the same sense that I could pick up my camera and just simply take a photo of a new, dressing or something at the store and send it to my wife. That's not a form of art. So at what point do these two things actually become art?
Yeah. Well, I would argue that both of those things are unfortunately art as well. It's just, they're not necessarily good. But they are both art. I have been pushing myself. This is one of those things that's very tough where it's not second nature yet for me. Because I've been indoctrinated by the kind of neoliberal late capitalist society that we live in. When you look back at someone like John Dewey from like the 1920s and his lectures on art as experience, I think that our world that we live in is so specialized, and it's trying to make art this specialized, separate experience from life. And it's doing that effectively enough that we see it that way. But that's not actually the way that the world operates. Like, we're working against the way that the world should operate. We're like, everything we do should be suffused with art and artfulness. And we should be aware of that. I mean, the thought that really struck me like a bell was this idea of like, we call it a work of art, and in doing so, say that the thing itself is not the art. It is the aftermath of the art, right? It's a work of art. Art is the doing, right? And a lot of artists will say that's the process, but honestly, I think it's living. And it's that when you say, I'm going to paint this wall and it's not going to be art, you're engaging in a defeatist mentality. Like, why shouldn't it be art? Like, why shouldn't you be thinking artfully about it? In the same way, like, if you're trying to communicate with yourself about this, you know, bottle of salad dressing, like, why wouldn't you take a second to consider the proper aestheticizations, the proper like physical form of that? Now, is that going to be the same as looking at the Pietà in St. Peter's? Like, no. But I think ignoring that we all have the potential for that artistry at every second, every interaction, makes our lives much more boring and more bland. So this is something that's like philosophically something I'm trying to like live by more, because I think it's deep down suppressed nature. And so it's not like directly at hand, because we're so used to the idea that we outsource artfulness to other people instead of doing it ourselves or thinking about it ourselves.
Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit. Yeah, you're right. That's an entirely new way of thinking about it. So obviously, though, when you... This is a relatively new realization to you,
yeah.
Especially in the timeline of you shooting and being involved in photography. So early on, when you didn't have, I would say, this mindset, right? You kind of... I want to go back to those 16 roles that you said that you had. And you said that they were just all over the place.
Yeah.
But you still bought another 16 roles after that.
Yeah.
What were you hoping to... Let me rephrase the question. What was, when you said that they're all over the place, where were they all over the place, and what do you think it was that you struggled with the most?
With that, it was just a matter of difficulty from a technical standpoint, where I was, you know, I didn't have any sense whatsoever of what an f-stop or a shutter speed was. Like, I mean, I had a general sense of what the shutter speed was, but I was like, what does this f-stop thing do? Like, how does it operate? And so I literally just went out into the world and like took a photo at each of the f-stops and at each of the shutter speeds and was like, that's one roll. Great, cool. And like took notes. And so the changes were like kind of empirical changes. But when I saw a photo where I was like, that's a photo I took, the exposure looks right, everything's in focus, and it looks the way I want it to. Not just that it looks the way it looked, but like it looks the way I want it to. It expresses the, you know, the thing I'm going for. That was happening like once per roll, even from the start. But I was like, that's enough. That's enough to want me to get, or make me want to get better at doing this process. And so that's why I bought a second set, you know, and that's why I went through, you know, another several hundred photos to get to that point of like understanding how the camera itself worked, so that each time I would see something, I would have a certain amount of confidence I'd be able to grab it and capture it.
So how did you move forward with those next 16 rolls? Did you essentially just take the same approach, or did you alter it up a little bit?
Yeah, no, I looked and you know, said, okay, this was, I took a note that this was a sunny day and that there weren't any clouds and that these settings are what I used on 5, 6, whatever, you know, photos in a row. And so this is the type of setting I should use in that scenario, and tried to sort of commit that to memory. Obviously didn't do a great job of it necessarily because I just had to keep doing it. But I think also there's something really magical about film photography has like, I've always thought it has a kindred nature with ceramics because my mom's a ceramicist. And so she was dealing with the same problems I was dealing with while I'm taking these photos. It's also, I think, akin to baking a little bit, where you do all this work on the front end, you try to get your formula just right. And when it turns out perfectly, you feel great, but not as great as like the distance between where you are and how good you feel isn't as great as how bad you feel when it doesn't turn out. So like if a kiln explodes and like all this work is lost, you feel worse than if it had, than the sort of good value if it had turned out. And the same thing for me was true with taking photos with film. Like, it's like, I missed that shot. I cannot do that again. It doesn't exist anymore. I can't take that photo again. It's gone. Like, something about it has disappeared. And that burn makes you really want to fix it and acts as a stimulant on your learning, I think, of like, I'm not going to mess that up next time. And so I learned pretty quickly with regards to that. Now, obviously, like, I had one camera and one lens and kind of one speed of film, one type of film. So there was all sorts of other stuff that I needed to learn fairly quickly to expand my vocabulary. But just being in a situation of taking pictures and wanting them to turn out well and having them turn out poorly was all it took to sort of encourage me to do better next time and take good notes and try to remember.
How long would you say that you went through this process of
shooting and not liking your photos, because eventually you went on to school to get your master's of fine art. So it obviously wasn't terrible enough that you thought, I'm just going to give up on this and do something else.
Yeah, no, it was, I think I adapted really quickly because when the photos were good, they were good. They were already like, that's a good photo. That's an interesting photo that looks the way I want it to and looks evocative. And in some instances, it looks like what everyone else would shoot in the same situation with the same camera, but it was speaking my language, which is interesting because I always, and this is a totally different tangent, so don't let me go down it, but I wonder about the ease of photography now and how direct the experience is now, and whether or not people have the same issue of like ever not being able to express themselves adequately photographically. But I digress.
No, I do want to go a little bit more down that road. Are you saying because digital photography is essentially easy, it's easy to expose an image that now, mm-hmm. because there's not so much of a learning curve, the mountain to get over to get there, because it's not so high, the juice isn't so sweet on the other side, that maybe we don't pursue it as far? No,
I mean, that is an argument that I think is suited for a person 20 years older than me. That is absolutely like an old fogey argument. And I remember distinctly an old photographer who I worked with saying photography hasn't gotten any better in the last 150 years. It's just gotten easier. And I think there is something to be said for that. It is easier. For me, it's not that the juice isn't as sweet. It's the question of when I was growing up, I didn't have a camera. And so expressing myself photographically was something that I didn't come to until I was in my late teens, early 20s. I don't know that there are people who are in a position of not being able to express themselves photographically now with an iPhone. Maybe you can't write a soliloquy, but you can at least give me a laundry list photographically. Like, you can pull out your phone, you can say, this is what's happening in my world I exist in, and here it is. And so the distance from zero, from being photographically mute, to being capable was huge for me, and was part of why I wanted to have that journey, because it was this revelation. It was really like they had, I'd been deaf or something, and they had just turned it on. It's actually, mute is much better. Like, all of a sudden I got my voice. But if you're able to communicate rudimentarily, then is it worth it to hit that mountain? Like, do you need to get to that point? And when you do, do you sense there's some diminishing return? That's something I am trying to figure out while I'm teaching my students, because I'm trying to think about how to encourage them and how to push them, and how far do they have to go, and trying to relate to their experience. So that's more what I'm thinking about with that.
Yeah, you're right. That was I went somewhere totally different with that.
No. I mean, I you picked up on the breadcrumb. It's like it's right next to the old fogey argument, for sure. Like, it really is. They're adjacent things. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think about the same things sometimes. I didn't get started with digital photography like you. I kind of got started with film and just kind of practicing. But I also went to film school where I was taught how to expose for film. So I think it's a little bit different for me. And I sometimes have a hard time connecting that with newer photographers as well as to how to do it, because the only answer that I can think of is just do more, just go shoot more, and you have to figure it out. So if you figure out some sort of answer, please let me know, because I'd love to hear it. That's
for sure.
Something really interesting.
Yeah.
Now, so you went to school for your master's, you got your master's in fine arts. And then you were in New York City for a while, and you worked with some fashion and commercial photographers, right? What was your goal at that point as far as photography, and what did working with those fashion and commercial photographers do to help you along with that goal?
So first, we have to flip that order. I worked in the commercial industry, and then I went and got my MFA.
Okay.
So it was like, that's the the answer to your question is like working with them pushed me to then go and get my MFA. But yeah, I was, I was in Seattle for my undergrad, University of Washington, studied art history and history, and was, in this sort of degree path when I came to this realization about wanting to take photos and sort of self-taught for the most part. And then took a couple classes at Photo Center Northwest, which is this like kind of wonderful little nonprofit school gallery space, darkroom space in Seattle. Took some basic classes there to sort of get into the more technical aspects of photography. And in doing that, started realizing like I should probably, if I want to get better at this, I should probably put serious pressure on myself by working in this field. Like if I really want to get good at this, I should have someone's livelihood at stake. And so I started assisting photographers and assisted in Seattle for about a year and a half or so, like as I was finishing college, and then for about a year afterwards. And you top out in Seattle pretty quickly in the commercial world. And I mean, I wasn't at the top, but I could see that like the photographers I was working with, like they were all kind of chafing against what there was there, and some of them were moving. And so I happened to go to New York for a technical demo, actually, on like medium format digital backs, which no one was using in Seattle at the time, and fell in love with New York. I was like, I have to be in this place. This is the place to be, especially for the industry I was in. And so moved there, not knowing anybody, not having any connections, sent out 50 emails a day, every day for a week and a half until somebody was like, yeah, come be on set and see what happens. Met a couple other assistants who I connected with really well, and they brought me on as second assistants on some jobs. And then, by 4.5 years later, I was doing lighting design and doing digital tech work and doing, a lot of retouching work, shooting my own stuff, but recognized that the commercial side of things wasn't where I was going to hang my hat. And part of that was just I happened to stumble upon this group of photographers who were all fine artists first. These people who were kind of being brought into the fashion industry for the most part. So like Ro Etheridge, Alex Prager, Collier Shore, Marilyn Minter, Ryan McGinley. They were actually all being commercially represented by the same agent at the time. And so I was just doing lighting for them and doing stuff on set for them. And being around them, the energy was so different than with a typical commercial photographer. In many ways, they were less capable, but they were so much more certain of what they wanted to do. They were so much less likely to take what a art director wanted to give them or a client wanted to give them. They would, they had a certainty about themselves. And in talking to them over the course of a couple of years, it was just this realization of like, no, that's kind of where I need to head. And one of the ways to do that would be to get an MFA. And at that point, I was also getting burnt out on New York. So I was like, this is a great excuse to jump ship, have a built-in cohort. Whoever I go to school with is going to be my friends. And it's a reason to get out. And so looked around, applied to a couple of places, fell in love with San Francisco in the process. So, yeah.
I want to know about that. That little area right there, because yeah. So many people, sorry, I totally screwed this whole thing up. My brain was going in a million directions. I remember I was so excited to go to film school. I went to the film school right after high school. Mm-hmm. I went to film school, and right as I got into film school, like the teachers were all like industry professionals at some point. Yeah. And they were like, this is an industry where you don't even need to go to school. Like you can just learn on set.
Yeah.
And you kind of took the opposite approach. You mm-hmm. learned on set, but mm-hmm. then you decided to go to school. So what was it that you were hoping to get out of school that you weren't able to get in the experience of shooting on set?
Yeah. Man, a million things. Though I think that the truth is so much of what I thought I would get out of this, of school didn't materialize. And I don't, I have a hard time with this because I absolutely would 100% do my grad school experience over again, 10 times out of 10. But I also wouldn't recommend it to most people. Because I don't know that everyone goes in recognizing how hard they will have to work to get the resources that they're paying for. You don't get out of it what you put, what you pay into it. Like, you have to be kind of like extracting constantly. And I think I got that. I mean, the reason I ended up at the San Francisco Art Institute was at the time there was this roster of, like, to me, amazing and legendary artists who, like, across a number of fields, and like, the, it's a very interdisciplinary program, and who I was like, I'm going to get some exposure to them. Like, I'm not going to go to a school that has like two professors and I become an acolyte of that one of those two professors. Like, it's not who I am. Also, it just, I was so fearful of, like, what if I get there and they don't like me? But with this school, there were so many people who I could expose myself to and could sort of become friends with. I mean, there's, in my gallery right now, we have one of my grad school professors in there, like a show with a work of his and with his grad school professor as well. So it's this, like, this kind of community that built out of it, that I think was vital. Like, my gallery wouldn't exist without it. Like, none of the jobs I have would exist without it. But I know plenty of people who weren't, who thought that it was going to be more of a passive learning experience where it's like, I will be there as a pupil and I will be taught things. And I think to a certain degree, I thought there might be some of that as well, but there really wasn't any of that. It was however much you dig in to get the sort of advice, mentorship, and critique that you need, you'll get. So what I went in with, or what I went in expecting, maybe is less material than what I got out of it. But the closest matchup for me is that I thought that I would get exposure to a lot of different kind of pedagogical strategies. I'd see how a lot of different people teach, so I could then get better at teaching myself. And that's exactly what happened. Like, I think I borrow from a dozen different artists on a daily basis when I'm teaching.
So when it came to these artists that you were kind of looking up to, that you were learning from, at some point to where you're at today, now you're kind of focused on contemporary art. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah.
So for many people, including myself, I sometimes get lost in the different definitions of different types of art. So can you tell me, you know, what is contemporary art and how would you describe it?
Hey, Raymond here, and I know that diving into the world of editing can feel like navigating a maze, especially if you're just starting out. So that's why I created our exclusive collection of 52 Lightroom presets, absolutely free. While presets can dramatically enhance your photos, they're not a one-click solution. They're a starting point for your creativity and an opportunity to learn and grow in your editing skills. These presets work seamlessly with all versions of Lightroom, whether you're on a computer or using Lightroom Mobile. And they're designed to simplify your editing process, adding that professional touch to your photos while giving you the flexibility to fine-tune them to your taste. So if you're ready to take your photos to the next level, head over to freephotographypresets.com right now and get editing today.
Yeah, that's probably the toughest question. It's something that I think is actually the difficulty of describing it adequately is the most interesting thing about it. You know, when you go to law school, if you ask all the students who are in law school, what is law, they can give you a pretty good textbook definition. I think the definition of what is or isn't contemporary art changes moment by moment. I mean, to say that it's art that is made currently or in the contemporary period, the sort of the postmodern period, I think is really inadequate because there's a lot of art that's been made during that time that doesn't fit that definition. It's by and large stuff that's less concerned with materiality, more concerned with concept. I think that's probably the kind of best definition of it that I can find. But even that, you know, you see works that people like, you know, Liam Everett, whose his work is all about the material and all about the process and not about the content and not about the about sort of conceptualism at all. He's another grad school professor of mine, and he just popped into my head out of nowhere. But that's like, he's a great example. And his work is absolutely contemporary. So I struggle with the definition, too. And I think that's one of the reasons that some people gravitate towards it, is because it does fit this definition of like the avant-garde. It's at that front edge. And so you shouldn't be able to define it constantly. It's like defining is for things that have already happened, for things that are done. You know, that's the, this sort of, I don't even know if it's actually a Kierkegaard quote. I've just heard it so many times, but it's like, naming is an act of limiting. You know, you're trying to limit the number of things that a thing can be if you place a name on it. And I think that's like where we're at with contemporary art. For me, what's interesting is trying to figure out how that interacts specifically with photography. Not to keep rambling with quotes, but Charles Demaret, who was until recently the critic for the SF Chronicle, maybe the only inflammatory thing he wrote in his time as the critic was all art is either photography or considering photography. Which like I thought was fantastic. And he means all art that's being made now, because we exist in a photographic world, and you can't help but think about being visualized or being seen photographically. Your art is going to be photographed somehow, or you're going to reject it being photographed, which is in and of itself something photographic. But there's plenty of people who are making beautiful photographs that are photographic artists, and who are not necessarily thinking of themselves as conceptual artists or contemporary artists, like whose work doesn't slot into those categories. And I've heard people refer to that as like the photo ghetto, this sort of like separate outgrowth of like artistic photography, but that isn't within the sort of canonical progressive sort of structure of contemporary art. But for me, again, I don't really feel the need to be trying to place limits on it, because I think that it can wiggle back and forth, and any given photographer can operate in both spaces constantly. Like as we move into this like very odd new media landscape, like over the last couple decades, it's like you can be someone who's taking photographs that go into that become sculptures that go into a museum show. You can also shoot stuff for Time Magazine. You can also, you know, have an Instagram feed, and none of those are, well, truly less valid to the creator. They might be viewed differently by the consumer, but who cares about them? Like to the creator, it's like whatever path you need to take gets you to where you need to go. So for me, that's the most interesting part, is that especially with photography, it is trying seemingly actively to push away any of these definitions.
So where does you're right, and I guess that's what makes this kind of hard to talk about, especially on a podcast where it's mostly consumed through audio here. But I know in one of the emails that you had sent me, you had said that that you now lean away from quote unquote straight photography and more towards photography as an element of contemporary art.
Yeah.
So when I think, just in my head, the definition of straight photography would just be camera, whatever's in front of you, here we go, done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How does that differ from, like, what would photography in a contemporary setting look like to those listening trying to fully understand?
I think that for me, and again, this is like really a strictly personal definition, but it's photography that is an element of a contemporary practice is photography that acknowledges its own subjective position. So straight photography is caught up in the illusion of photography as something that is objective, something that, you know, sort of grew out of the sort of scientific industrial enlightenment revolutions. This concept of like, here is evidence of what really existed in the world. And it is evidence, but it's not proof. And I think that so often with documentary photography, with straight photography, we're saying this thing was in front of this camera, so it is real and it exists. And we're convincing ourselves that this isn't a lie of omission every time we look at a photo. Like the rest of the world doesn't count in that accounting. This is the evidence that was selected and the rest of it didn't exist. And I think that when photography is embedded in a contemporary practice, it plays with that more, it toys with that more, it obscures that completely, it pushes that away, or oftentimes it'll just acknowledge like this is photography as a diaristic form. This is like my photographs. This is the subjectivity of me being expressed. This isn't like the world as it happened. And in some instances that's done in ways that are so subtle as to be very difficult to even notice. In other ways, it's just having incredibly selective focus, taking photos of things that are more abstracted than you would take photos of if you were trying to really convey a strict message. You know, it's like, it's not Gary Winogrand walking down the street at, you know, F-16 on a 28 millimeter lens so that he's got everything from front to back completely in focus. It's not that sort of egalitarianism of the street photographer's lens. And if it is, then it's somehow being couched in other material. It's somehow being conveyed in a way that shows you, I'm not trying to convince you of a truthful world that isn't the world you're experiencing. I'm trying to show you me or what's embedded in my world. Does that make sense?
It's
woolly. It's a very woolly definition.
Yeah. I see that. But it does make sense in the way of like, so, you know, if we'll just take street photography, I suppose, because that's the example that I see in my head here. Maybe a photograph of somebody on the street would seem like street photography. Here we go. This is a photo of somebody on the street. But perhaps a body of street photography would be more contemporary because it's telling you more about the photographer than it is what's in front of the camera.
It could be absolutely, or you know, someone like Lee Friedlander, for example. It's like I absolutely think of Lee as being a contemporary artist. I mean, he's 90 something years old and he's been working in the street photography and road trip photography tradition for forever. I don't think that he's out to tell facts. I think he's out to tell truths. So I think that it's funny. Street photography is in this space that isn't fully defined. I think if we said like photojournalism, right, then that's like when I'm thinking of street photography, that's what I'm thinking of. It's like people who are trying to say a specific message with a specific image and that they are illustrating something that they think was factual. And when I think of a street photographer, I don't think that that's what's happening. I think what's happening is like they're creating a poem out of overheard things in the world, right? So it's like, so those overheard, like someone did say that for sure, but you're recontextualizing it. And that through that game of recontextualizing, we get that rush of like that happened, that those people walked by each other and they looked at each other that way. But that within the way that the sort of body of work is sequenced or the way that its you know, final form is presented, or even just the way that like the text that accompanies it kind of contextualizes it, we're given more of a sense of like this is a record of the subjective experience of a person, right? And as long as that's being acknowledged, then I feel a little bit more comfortable about saying it's within that space of the contemporary.
So if I think that definitely helped lay it out a lot more. Now for those listening, thinking to themselves, like, I like the sound of this. This is really interesting. What would you say would be, I mean, even the first steps for somebody who's interested more in contemporary art, but just has no idea where to start?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's, the first thing to do would be to look, for me, the first thing to do would be to look at New York MoMA and their photo department. They put on shows, annually, I think, that are new new emerging photographers that they find interesting. Now, obviously, like they're not that new, and they're not that emerging if they're on the radar of
recognized MoMA.
Yeah, exactly. But it does give you a sense of what themes and what styles are happening within that space. And you see something like that. You see a body of work by Paul Sapuya, and you're like, these photos are not things that are revealing to me clarity. Like these are photos that are like making me less certain about what I'm seeing in this process. And that's fascinating. And and then, I mean, honestly, at that point, we've got the internet. We're in a full like rabbit hole society. Then you're like, well, what other shows has he been in? Who else? Like, he's been in a ton of group shows. He's been a like very popular artist the last couple of years. Who's he shown with? What are the other galleries that show his work? Who else do they show? And then you just start hopping from photographer to photographer. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait, I'm at a sculptor now. Isn't this a sculptor? Like, those are sculptures. Oh no, those are photographs of sculptures. And the final form is a like someone like Miriam Baum, where it's like she's like it's a photographic print that you're seeing at the end, but like contained within it is sculptures made from other photographs. Or someone like Matt Lips, same thing, where it's like it's a singular plane of a photograph at the end, but there's physical collages that were photographed within that. And the question of like, what is a photograph? Like, where does a photograph start and stop? It's something, a question that we feel like we have such clarity to answer it until we're shown all these different things that are like, well, that is still a photograph, isn't it? Like, and so it's contingent. And I think that's where I would start is I'd go to New York MoMA is like kind of the iconic institution, but if you wanted to start anywhere, you could start at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Lisa Sutcliffe does a great job as a curator there. I just pick her because she's a friend, but her programming's fantastic, and she runs the gamut. Like, San Francisco MoMA has a fantastic, a huge photo collection. The thing is with SF MoMA, to their great credit, I think that they show a lot of work that is more canonical. They show stuff that's like already sort of in the advanced period. And that they bring in amazing stuff. Like, they have a huge Walker Evans show or a big Daewoo Bae show or Susan Mizellis show. Like, these aren't figures who, like, we're learning more about them certainly, but like they're not new to us. They're not showing us like what also like they're, I think their range, they do a great job. Clement Chereau just left, but as and Sandy Phillips before him as like the lead curators, I think that they seem, and I again don't know either of them on a personal level, but they seemed to be acting under this mandate of photography in this expansive realm where like they wanted to show a photojournalist as an artist because she works photographically and the product is something that absolutely looks like art. They wanted to show found photographs as art. They wanted to show like the show that that Clement put together called Oops. I think it was the Oops and the Art of the Mistake. It was like photographic errors that had been kind of allowed within photography by photographic artists. Like, expanding it. But I think that makes it actually, in some ways, that might muddy the issue for an average person who's starting to get into the idea of like the photograph as a contemporary art piece. I'd also say like looking at major galleries and like looking at their roster of photographers. I mean, a great place to start from my standpoint is Frankel Gallery in San Francisco, which is, I think, one of the great photo galleries in the world. They have a roster of artists and works they show that covers the entire range of photography, but especially the more sort of the younger practitioners. I think that you get to a space where you're like, wow, that's really almost not photography anymore. I mean, I feel really blessed with this. Like, San Francisco actually has a range of really amazing photo galleries. Case Moore Kirkaby is another gallery that's, friends of mine, and they show artists who are all over the place, from like, Jim Goldberg and Todd Heido, who are like various, and Larry Sultan, who are very established, kind of recognized artists, to like artists who are kind of just cutting their teeth in the world. Yeah, I think find a starting point and then recognize how to dig from there. Just to like finalize that thought, find someone whose work you like and then figure out every show that they've ever been in. Even if that means you have to like email them and ask them for a CV, just to like look through and then find the other people who are in those shows and keep track and like have, I mean, I could show you, but like I have like a 1,000 browser tabs open in like three different browsers right now. It's like I got this one for Firefox and Chrome and Safari. It's just like 1,000 on all of them. It's like I got all of them open. I can click on any of them anytime. Same thing on my phone. So do a deep dive that way. That's what I'd say.
We got to help you out with some tab management. That's just killing your computer. My goodness.
I know.
I like that sentiment that you had about, the idea of this show, Oops. I really like that because there's been plenty of times where I've taken photos that were totally happy accidents, and yet I love them. But you can't teach that. You're right. No. You can't teach that. That's not something that, especially because I think we're kind of taught that art has to have some sort of intention behind it. Mm-hmm. And when there's a total accident, how can you claim that as a victory of your own if you had no part in its happening?
Yeah, no, I think that that's, that show was actually a fantastic show. And I think it's, obviously COVID dependent. I think the plan was that show would travel actually, because they had put a significant amount of work into it. So it would probably be at other institutions as well. But it's the ability to take a photo accidentally has been, and a good photo at that, has been this like constant like dark shadow over photography for me forever, of like how much can you claim that the photograph is yours in the first place? You didn't design the camera, you didn't develop the film or sensor technology, like you didn't, none of that is yours. You don't have to understand optics or chemistry or electronics or computer science to be a fantastic photographer.
Yeah,
some of the best photographers I know have eschewed all of that stuff. But like, doesn't that mean that like you're collaborating?
In a sense, collaborating with people who you've never maybe come in contact with. But it's kind of the same like with everything. I mean, construction. There was that, obviously it was a few years ago now, but I remember President Obama got in a lot of trouble for, I don't remember exactly what the context was, but somebody was talking about the business that they had built, and he was like very successful, self-made man, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. He called himself a self-made man. And Obama's, reference, or his, not his reference, but his response was like, you didn't do that. Your business uses, the roads that, we had to build. It uses infrastructure. It uses the internet. Like, you didn't create any of that.
Yeah.
Like, you use these things as tools, but you're not self-made. Like, don't call yourself self-made. And that's kind of what it is that we're talking about here. But we're just using the tools that are available to us. And I think thinking of ourselves as collaborators rather than maybe working on this on our own is something that could potentially build a sense of community and maybe a higher purpose in the photos that it is that we're taking. I don't know. I kind of went off there. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts?
No. I have a million thoughts on that. And I think my only issue is to not take it too broadly, but like I do think we should be in a post competition and post individualism world. I think that's where like competition and rugged individualism absolutely got us to where we are. And you, as an individual, you get to decide whether you like that or not. I mean, the world's on fire around me, so I'm maybe like, that wasn't the best place for us to end up. But I do think going forward, as a society, we can say collaboration instead of competition can rule the day, and that cooperative community building and acknowledging our debts is more beneficial for us in growing than sort of strict senses of individual ownership. Like I make a photograph and I'm like, I have the copyright to that photo. And it's like, I literally could have accidentally dropped the camera and it took a photo. And it's like, that's more an engineer at Canon's responsibility than it is mine. But it's mine now, right? I think that this is something that gets caught in my head so much is because when I'll talk about someone like Jeff Koons or Damien Hirst or Anish Kapoor, these like contemporary sculptors who run essentially factories for their works, and they'll design the works, and then the artisans that they work with, the craftspeople they work with, the other artists that they work with, will fabricate them. And when I tell that to students, they oftentimes are stunned, and then they think that's not their work. Then, so that's not, it's not theirs. And part of me is like, it is theirs. Like in the same way that your photograph is yours. Like you're not acknowledging the people who made your camera. But also another part of me points to the film industry and says like, it's like a director, except the difference is that a director is forced legally to have the credits that credit every single other person who had a hand in the making of the film. And we don't have to have that in the rest of the art world. I think we should. I honestly think as annoying as it would be if every placard next to every photograph in a museum had to acknowledge the camera manufacturer, I think we'd be better off. I think we'd be thinking about this as an endeavor that like we're at the top of a thing that we didn't get to on our own. Mm-hmm. That, like, we created the shortcuts were created for us and we took advantage of them. And that, and like, that's not, I don't want everyone to reinvent the camera. I don't want everyone to even understand optics. I think it's a waste of time. I think you should acknowledge the debt and then go forward. That's why the people made the things in the first place, so that you could improve upon what they've done.
That, my friend, is a conversation for a whole nother series of podcast episodes, and one that I would love to have, because it would just be such an interesting thought experiment into what that world would look like and perhaps what would come out of it. But getting back on track here as far as contemporary art going on, now we've talked a little bit about the education, how to educate ourselves, mm-hmm. how to find some artists that that we enjoy. Now, as somebody, you know, educated like yourself, looking at lots of pieces of arts, what do you think are just some of the elements of photography that separate somebody who's brand new in their journey, they're an amateur, versus somebody who is a seasoned pro in specifically creating photographic art?
Yeah. One more thing that popped into my head. I think Aperture Magazine is a completely underutilized resource. It's one of the best publications of any kind in the world. Their writing is amazing. The writing on photography is amazing. The photography is amazing. They commission new work. They show existing work. And it's at this wonderful like nexus between photography as art and just photography in general. So if someone was like, I really don't know how to use the internet and want to like have a starting point, it's like, call up Aperture in New York, get them to send you some copies, like get a subscription, and then start diving in through that, and then use that as your resource tool. I think for me, the biggest problem I see with emerging photographers, I hate to use the term amateur, because some of the best photographs ever taken were by people who didn't get paid a dime for them. And that's
some
all
of my favorite photos I've ever taken are in the same sense. I get that.
Exactly. professionalism doesn't necessarily mean good, but early beginning photographers. How about that? we'll use that. They try to show too much. They want to get everything. They want it to be the whole thing. And that I, as a viewer of photography, but also someone who's critical of photography, I start to enjoy things at the point where I see that someone's made some real choices. Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest leap for a beginning photographer is when they first get a lens that can open super wide up. And all of a sudden, very little's in focus, and it's whatever they choose for it to be, or whatever they forget that they've chosen it to be. And that's, for me, the first point where I'm like, this is someone pointing to me. This is someone saying to me, look at this. And I think it's a vital step for people to start to realize that what you don't show is vastly more important than what you do show. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of the point of turn for me, is when someone starts to see and starts to show things in a limiting fashion rather than an expansive fashion.
So how do you teach that?
Some of that is just making sure that people have an understanding of what the tools that they possess can and can't do. That's sort of the
from a technical standpoint.
Well, yeah, from a technical standpoint. And I think that's something that is so fascinating to me about photography, is that it is such a technical medium, and the magic of it has all been sort of has been compartmentalized scientifically in a way that, like, painting is also incredibly technical. It's just that it hasn't been compartmentalized in the same way. It's a little bit more hidden. It's not as programmatic. But so the technical side, though, does absolutely change what you're capable of showing, what you're capable of doing. It's like any other tool. Like, you can't, you know, you're not going to perform open heart surgery with a hatchet, you know, and you're not going to cut down a tree with a scalpel. And so knowing that tool in your hand is only capable of certain things, or is capable of all sorts of things, but at a really base, shallow level. That's something I think that is, I ease them into that usually, because they've oftentimes just spent a ton of money on a new camera and they've got a kit lens on it. And they're like, wait, this is supposed to do everything. It's like, yeah, it's a Swiss Army knife. It really is. Do you want to do open heart surgery with a Swiss Army knife? Do you want to cut down a forest with a Swiss Army knife? Like, no, it's like, you've got this do everything tool that doesn't do a great job of anything. And so showing them visual examples, like, to give them a sense of, like, these are things you can't do with what you have. Know if that's important or not to you, and try within the boundaries of what you have. But also, like, for me, it's forcing them into specific territory. Like, in a Digital One class, every student has a zoom lens. They don't have prime lenses anymore. And so saying, okay, now we're going to set it to this specific focal length and this aperture, and you're only going to shoot things at this focal length and this aperture for the next week. And you're going to limit yourself. And if you want to get closer to something, you have to get closer to it. If you want to get further away from it, you have to get further away from it. You have to be more aware of where you're standing as a result. You have to do all those things. And at that point, you start to think, what am I leaving in the frame and what am I taking out of it? Because otherwise, what you see is, I mean, I'll look at their entire, their entire memory cards, and I'll see that they shot 15, 20 photos of the same subject from the same angle at different focal lengths, thinking, I'm getting the whole thing in. You're not going around it at all. You're not seeing it from other sides. You're just getting more or less of the world around it in the shot. And as a result, none of those photos are good or usable usually. You're not considering the object at all.
Okay, so I think that was a perfect explanation. And I'm trying to figure out, because I know that we're at the end of our time here, but I got one last question for you.
Take as much time as you want, man. I'm not stressed.
Don't tempt me. I will do that. I will do that. As far as, you know, when it comes to teaching photographers, what is just some commonly bad information that you hear being taught to those new to photography?
Oh God, all sorts, man. let me think. I mean, I think one of the things that comes up all the time is that they think that they have to have a big and expensive camera for it to be able to take good photos. And it's funny, because I do think having a big, expensive camera is a great platform to learning about taking photos, to have all of those options so you can test them all out and you can try them all out. And so you can understand how different lenses work and you know, what things look like when they're at, you know, huge high resolution, and how to make big prints. If I had my druthers, I'd give everybody like the absolute top of the line Nikon with a full suite of lenses at the beginning of the semester to try out absolutely everything that they can with that one camera, and I'd have on hand other cameras as well. But the truth of the matter is the only camera that you should be shooting with is the camera that is the most comfortable for you for that situation. And oftentimes that's not a big bulky camera. Oftentimes that's a small, simple camera. In fact, sometimes it's an iPhone. So I think you have to have those options in order to like understand what they do. But then once you've done that, I think you should absolutely like scale back and have just what you need and think about things within that. Also, I think it's super helpful because you do still always have your iPhone on you. You know, I think I was in, let me see here. I was in New York and I was shooting, like I was, you know, walking around the street with a friend shooting and I had like a fairly like weird lens to be on the street shooting with. I had like an 85mm like f1.4, I think, which isn't like, it's not long enough to be doing creepy telephoto stuff. It's not wide enough to be doing street shots really. And my friend was like, well, like, why aren't you shooting with a zoom if you want that length? Like, then you can get everything else too. I was like, no, because this, you know, this limits me. And like, I like having parameters and also obviously like I've got the depth of field to contend with. And he's like, but what happens if like an alien lands and like you're too close to it to like be able to get the whole thing? And it's like, you know, that's a really interesting question. I have my iPhone though. Like if I need the like, oh my God, something unprecedented is happening, I have to capture this, I always have that thing literally in my back pocket to pull out and get the whole thing. And I'll get it in 4K video actually the mm-hmm. whole time. Like it's not what I need to be taking photos of with my walking around camera. And I think that recognition that we're not all out there as photojournalists trying to capture the highest res photos of like day-to-day events, like the things that are like newsworthy, unless we are that. I think that's something that was a critical realization for me. And I think that a lot of my students still don't understand. Like they assume that they should walk in the street with 3 or 4 cameras on them at all times and be prepared right. for everything. It's like, no, you should actually like maybe go out with just one tool and have it be the right tool and miss some shots as a result, but get the shots with that tool that are exactly right.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Chris. That was perfect, and I think that was the perfect thing to end this interview with. I have to tell you that I really appreciate your time and sharing this really kind of deep conversation that we had about photography. It was a little different than normally what we do here, but I enjoyed it, and I hope that the listeners will as well. And if they don't, well, then they can tune this one out. So
exactly.
I know that they will.
I had a great time too. Thanks for having me on. I can talk about this sort of stuff all the time.
Yeah, well, maybe you should start your own podcast, because I'll tell you what, you got at least one listener for sure. I will definitely nice. Show up. Before I let you go, though, if anybody's listening and they want to learn more about you, can you share where they can find you online?
Yeah, my website is chrisgrunder.com. Pretty straightforward. My gallery is bassandrainer.com, which shows you a very different side of me in a way. And then I'm also on Instagram at Grunder. Thanks so much.
I really hope that you enjoyed today's interview with Chris Grunder. I would love to hear your biggest takeaway, either a light bulb moment or something that you are going to implement into your photography. You can share it with me by reaching out via the contact page at beginnerphotographypodcast.com. From there, you can leave me a voicemail. Voicemails allow me to share your thoughts or your questions in your own words right here in an upcoming episode of the podcast. There's nothing to download. And of course, you can preview what you say before you hit send. So head over to beginnerphotographypodcast.com to send me your voicemail now. Until next week, remember, the more that you shoot today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoy the show, consider leaving a review in iTunes. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.